Be among the first to experience Ardent Community's newest luxury apartments in Galloway, Ohio, The Pinnacle and The Reserve at Parkside Village. Enjoy spacious, modern floor plans designed for comfort, style, and convenience. Amenities built around your lifestyle, beautiful finishes, thoughtful community spaces, and the perfect location. Move in now and live rent-free for 2 full months. Start fresh in a place that truly feels like home. The Pinnacle and The Reserve at Parkside Village. Call or visit ardentcommunities.com to schedule a tour or check out our rent specials.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, the latest in corrective eye surgery. Can you reverse the natural decline of your vision? I'll be hearing from consultant ophthalmic surgeon specialising in cataract and refractive surgery, Brendan Cummings. Christine Higgins on how burnout led her to sell her thriving business, move into a more spiritual way of life, and set up a monthly full moon event which attracts thousands to the beach, all for a suicide awareness charity. And Theo Kerwin set up salad restaurant chain Sprout & Co. with his brother Jack, and I'm a super fan. It's hard to find another place which delivers that many veg and taste in one bowl. Theo has just released his first book, Saladology, and I'll be asking him about learning to cook with his mum as a child, going viral on TikTok, sharing recipes, and I really hope he's brought me a salad. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, I'm back after a much needed week in the sun. We hadn't been on a family holiday like that since before COVID. Now, I am a big fan of a staycation. We have an amazing country with fantastic food, and I love piling everything into the car. And I've also become a lot more conscious these days about taking flights, but the sun was calling me, a privileged position, I know. I have felt really tired of late, and I just wanted to flake out on a sunbed and dip in the sea, and that is exactly what I did. I also felt that as a family, we needed that week of connection. It's getting trickier as the kids are getting older and looking for more independence. So it was great to get the teenager off the screen. We were playing cards, we were hanging out at the beach, and I managed to totally unwind. There has been a lot going on over the last while, and the sun was a massive ingredient in taking us out of our everyday lives and into something completely different. Loved it. I've been feeling great after it, and I want to try and hang on to this feeling for as long as possible. And closer to home, the day before we left for Portugal, I went to the most gorgeous day retreat that I want to give a mention to in Roundwood in Wicklow. Dee Creasy and her husband Derek have the most beautiful home, surrounded by nature, plants, flowers, chickens, veg, the whole lot. And they're both experts on what grows around them. Dee runs the retreats and she collaborates with various well-being experts, all with a focus on nature and rambling around her garden. The sun was also a feature on that day, I would have to say. And we drank hawthorn tea in the garden. We learned all about the plants in her garden. We ate a veggie lunch, mostly made up from the veg patch. We had yoga and yoga nidra, which is basically you lying there while they say relaxing stuff, with Liz Costigan Fleury. I brought my lovely sister-in-law. We met a great bunch of women. Men are welcome too, but it is called Knocknamon, so Women's Hill, because it is a space that was owned by Derek's grandmother. So they're really leaning into the feminine. Women seem to be attracted to things like this, but there are men always welcome. But there was women there on that day, and I just came back from it feeling so much more relaxed. I mean, I got back to the house and I can't remember. Something small and stressful happened, something to do with packing the kids. I don't even really remember, but I caught myself doing a learned behaviour of, I don't know, maybe reaching for my phone, something I do to kind of self-soothe. Sometimes I disappear off down to the magnifying mirror to tweeze my eyebrows and just take a minute. I mean, the vices could be worse, people. But I went to do something like that and I thought, I actually don't need to do that because it hadn't tipped me over the edge. If you think of your stress levels as a water bottle, if your stress level is already near the top, any small thing makes that water overflow. But if you bring down your stress levels to the bottom, something will never really tip you up. It'll annoy you in the moment, but it'll fade away. And that's how I felt coming back from that day. So we need to really lean into things like that. I mean, something like a retreat day might not be possible for all of you. I tried to back out of it. I was thinking, no, we're going away the next day. The dates don't match. This is ridiculous. I don't have time. You make the time. Make it work. Put yourself first. But also lean into some of the things that I learned. The deep breathing, the yoga nidra. Throw one onto to YouTube. Lie down and chill out. Get out in nature. Take a few deep breaths. All of these things bring us from fight or flight to rest and digest and bring our stress levels down. If you want to find out what else is happening in Roundwood in Wicklow, you will find Dee on Instagram at Knock Na Mann. So it's spelled the Irish way. I have a post on my page at Claire McKenna Presents, and I would highly recommend. You can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, Brendan Cummings is a consultant ophthalmic surgeon specialising in cataract and refractive surgery at the Beacon in Dublin. Working in various hospitals around the country over the last few years, his fellowship training is in cataract and refractive surgery with the Wellington Eye Clinic, and he joins me in studio now to discuss the latest in surgical advancements to save or return to 20/20 vision. Brendan, you're very welcome.
Thanks so much, Claire. It's great to be here.
When I have an expert in any area of medicine, I'm always fascinated as to why you would choose that topic. What made you pick the eyes?
Wow, okay, that's a very interesting question. I suppose that the very short answer is that if you have to pick one body part to look at all day, every day for the rest of your career, eyes are a really appealing one, as opposed to looking up noses or in the ears or elsewhere. But I suppose that the honest answer is that eye care is a part of medicine where the huge majority of our interactions with patients leave them in a better position afterwards. There's a lot of stuff we can do to make your vision better, make your eyes more comfortable. And then there's kind of a high turnaround in that you see lots of patients. You kind of have some long-term patients, but you're kind of always meeting new people, which is quite appealing to me. And then the surgery side is what also I really like. It's kind of very delicate surgery. It takes a lot of attention to detail, and ophthalmology is a really, really kind of data-driven specialty in the fact that, you know, the eyes are so accessible to instruments, to scans. We can see into them. There's so much you can tell looking into somebody's eyes about their general health. To be honest, there's so much about it that I love. And I have a bad back, so I can't stand for too long. So you sit down operating, which is nice.
Interesting. And I've brought my glasses in case I need them. I've got them in the last couple of years. What about your own eye health?
Yeah, well, I mean, so I was short-sighted with astigmatism as a child. I remember getting glasses for the first time at 9 and realising, gosh, you can actually see the leaves on trees. You know, I thought that was just a thing that people drew. So I wore glasses up until I was about 18 years old, and then I had LASIK when I was 18, and I suppose I haven't looked back since.
And was that maybe the start of you thinking, obviously at 18 you were doing your leaving, you had an idea you might get enough points to go in medicine, but that was part of the jigsaw?
I'd actually tried to avoid medicine. My dad's a doctor, and he's quite a successful doctor, and he's a very, very good doctor, and I was quite hesitant to follow in his footsteps in case I was kind of in his shadow. But then when I kind of got into looking into medicine, I figured, look, I really, really like this. So then I tried to avoid ophthalmology because I thought, look, I can still be a doctor, but I won't be in his shadow. But then when I went through all the training, I figured, actually, I like ophthalmology the best. So I've kind of followed in his footsteps, trying everything else along the way, which is a nice position to be in because I know I've kind of made the decision for the right reasons. And now I have, you know, a mentor who's, you know, more than a mentor can be. So, but yeah, I mean, I also have a little bit of dry eye, which is also something that's really, really prevalent, especially people who are on screen a lot get a lot of dry eye from kind of screen fatigue and digital eye strain. So it helps a little bit in empathizing with patients and also talking them through what to expect during a procedure if you've been through it yourself.
I felt that the phone definitely contributed to the degeneration of my eyesight. I mean, obviously, I'm in my 40s. It's going to happen. But the phone was where I started to feel it. The most. I do a lot of voiceover at a home recording studio. I hold a phone up to read the script and it started to go blurry. And we're constantly putting our eyes under strain to read text messages and read small print. Is that contributing to a decline in eye health or eyesight?
So I suppose there are potentially two things at play with your own personal experience. I suppose the first thing is that our eyes will naturally lose the ability to focus up close as we get older. The part of your eye that does the focusing is the lens, and it sits just behind the colored part of your eye. So a teenager or somebody in their 20s or 30s, their lens is very, very flexible. And if they have good distance vision with glasses or without glasses, they can also see right under their noses by changing the shape of their lens. But the lens loses that flexibility over time. It just gets kind of stiffer. And eventually your near point gets further and further away from you, the near point that you can focus on. And so, you know, in our early 40s, we notice that we've got to hold things further away. And then eventually our arms aren't really long enough to read things, and we get a pair of reading glasses. So the phone is kind of at a distance where you would start to notice that change. It's called presbyopia, and it happens to everybody. You know, it's just a natural part of aging. But then the other thing with screens and phones is that there is this condition called digital eye strain, or sometimes people call it computer vision syndrome. And for some reason, when we are looking at a screen that's backlit, like a computer screen or a phone or a tablet, a few things change about the way our eyes behave. So to have a comfortable eye and to see clearly, you need a stable layer of fluid on the surface of your eye. It's called your tear film. And the tear film is made up of water. There's something called mucin, which is the white stuff that you find in the corner of your eye sometimes in the morning. And then there's an oil layer. And the oil layer comes from these tiny little oil glands just behind your eyelashes. And when you blink and the top lid comes down and hits the bottom lid, a little bit of oil is released, and that oil coats your tear and stops it from evaporating too quickly. Now, for some reason, when we are looking at a screen, especially when we're really concentrating, the first thing that changes is we don't blink as often. So you blink maybe half as often. So you've got half the times that the oil is being released. But the second thing is we do these incomplete blinks. So if you're ever kind of watching a colleague who's really concentrating on a screen, and you kind of watch their blink, you'll see that the blink goes maybe three quarters of the way down their eye and then goes back up again. It's really, really kind of strange thing if you start looking for it, but it just means that the oil is not released, so your tears evaporate faster. And if you think about it, the first thing that light hits when it hits your eye isn't your eye, it's this layer of fluid. So if this layer of fluid is evaporating and it evaporates in little patches, your vision goes fuzzy. And that's kind of why dry eye and spending a lot of time on screen, people feel they've got to squeeze their eyes closed every now and then. That's just your subconscious way of saying, look, squeeze some more oil out of these oil glands so that we can see a bit better for longer.
That's absolutely fascinating. I also brought my 10-year-old daughter for an eye test, and it turned out that she did need glasses to wear constantly. And the optician said that they are starting to look now at the amount of young people who are coming who are now short-sighted, so they can't see far away because they're doing so much close work. And my daughter would have had 3 years of homeschooling on a tablet during COVID, as well as obviously there is tablet use for recreational purposes as well in her life. And that is starting to have an impact rather than being out in the field and spending more time looking far away.
Exactly. That it's actually probably, if you had to ask somebody who looks at kind of global health or population health, what is the biggest threat to our eyesight in 20, 30 years' time? It's this, you know, maybe it's an overused word now, but this epidemic of myopia or short-sightedness. Asia is maybe 20 years ahead of us in terms of this because of the kind of intense schooling systems there. But, you know, too much screen time use or too much up-close work as a child predisposes you to becoming short-sighted. But the biggest thing is actually the lack of outdoor time that we have now. So as children growing up, you need, they recommend 2 hours of outdoor time a day for a developing child to reduce their risk of developing short-sightedness. And being a little bit short-sighted is an inconvenience, but being very short-sighted is actually a pathological condition. It increases your risk of developing lots of sight-threatening things later on in life, like glaucoma or retinal detachments, or you can get kind of issues with the macula, the central part of the back of your eye, and cataracts happen at a younger age. So it's something that, to be honest, the companies that develop, like Apple, and, you know, they are starting to look into this because they're figuring, you know, it's a little bit like smoking 50 years ago. You know, all the tobacco companies were making huge money off cigarettes, and then they figured, gosh, you know, there's going to be a class action lawsuit against us because we're contributing towards this myopia epidemic. So they're starting to, you know, put reminders in tablets saying, look, is that enough time? You know, they're starting to think, how is the way that people are behaving using these tablets and phones impacting their long-term health, but especially for children? I mean, the dry eye alone, I was reading a study recently on children and digital eye strain, and about 60% of children have digital eye strain, you know, people that are under 12, because of the tablet use. We're just not evolved to look at screens all day.
Yeah, and look, it's very easy to be defensive and say, look, we're all doing our best, you know, but we need to have these conversations to actually bring about the change. It's not about blame, but it's about learning.
The other thing is, if it's identified, like it has been with your child, there are things you can do to slow down the progression. So, you know, there are medications, there are treatments that we have that can slow down the degree of short-sightedness. Because if you're kind of more than minus six is the cutoff, or you're kind of a high myope, then these risks of, you know, other eye things go up. But if you're a low myope, then your risk is relatively low. Like I was a low myope and my dad was a low myope. You can treat that. You know, when you're an adult, you can have laser vision correction, or there are, you know, lots of different procedures you can do to correct your short-sightedness. But the issue is if you're minus 10 and you have laser vision correction or some other procedure, your eye is still the size of a minus 10 eye and you still have those increased risks.
Wow, that's interesting. You said earlier that you can see a lot by looking into someone's eye and it can give you an indication of a lot of their health. Tell us a bit more about that.
Well, I suppose if you think about the conditions that, you know, the general health issues that people face or worry about or impact their quality of life or duration of life, it's things like diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol. And most of those conditions affect your blood vessels in some way. So your kind of risk of a heart attack is higher if you've got high cholesterol. Your risk of kind of issues with diabetes is higher if you have high blood sugar. But you in the eye, you can look at the blood vessels in person. So, you know, if you look at your hand, you can kind of see the kind of blue shadows where the veins are, but you can't see them. Whereas in the eye, they're exposed. You can see the retinal arteries, the retinal veins. So you get a very, very good idea of what the health of the person's, the rest of the body's vasculature is like by looking at the eyes specifically. So it gives you, you know, unbelievable. That's part of the reason why ophthalmology is such an exciting specialty, is because there's so much information you can gain from somebody's eye just by looking into it. I mean, there's a lot of studies showing that you can predict somebody's risk of Alzheimer's and dementia by measuring the thickness of their retinal nerve fiber layer. So we can do scans to measure how thick is this. You know, the retina is an extension of your brain. It's connected to your brain directly. So you can kind of see somebody's part of somebody's brain looking into their eyes. And obviously that can give you a lot of insight, more than kind of a scan can.
And there's been a lot of talk about hearing loss and the impact that can have on dementia risk being increased, because obviously you're not getting the sound in, you're not kicking your brain into gear, and then there are certain things that will wind down. Is that the same with sight? Because obviously we're taking in a lot of information and processing it in our brain. If we're not taking in sight well, or at 20/20, does that impact how well our brains work?
So it does. So the kind of the latest research suggests that it's not as impactful as hearing loss, but it definitely impacts your brain health. I suppose there are a number of reasons why that happens. The first is that the less well you can see, typically the less the poor your engagement in day-to-day life is. So if you're not able to see, maybe you stop doing the crossword or you stop reading. And as you know, kind of feeding your brain with new information or kind of challenging tasks is what keeps your brain working and keeps it young. The second thing is that if your vision is poor, your brain has to do much more processing power for you to try to make out what you're seeing. Because you see with your brain, your eye is, you know, essentially a biological camera. So if the camera's out of focus, you can still try to make out what you're seeing, but it takes a lot of processing power. And that leads to kind of fatigue, you know, brain fatigue, which will also then lead to, you know, less engagement in life. And then, you know, being active and you know, exercising and going out for walks, people who don't see well or who have eye issues can kind of withdraw from active life, which is a big part of, you know, the dementia risk. And then less communication. I mean, a lot of our communication these days, unfortunately, is digital. You know, it's texting or emailing. And if you withdraw from that, again, you're less connected to your social network, which is a huge risk for dementia, is kind of social isolation. So it does. It absolutely does. And, you know, one of the interventions that we do for people, actually, I think in 2023, it was the most commonly performed surgery worldwide, is cataract surgery. So a cataract is when that lens that I was describing earlier, that helps you to have this range of focus, loses its clarity and goes cloudy. And so we now replace the cataract with an artificial lens. And that lens technology has evolved massively, you know, in the last 75 years, but especially in the last maybe 10, 15 years. And so it means that, you know, we can now replace a cataract with a new artificial lens that allows you to see, you know, extremely well. For some people, it's the best that they've ever seen. If they have a high prescription, we can fix their prescription as well. But the reason why I'm talking about that is because cataract surgery reduces your risk of falls, reduces your risk of dementia, because it, you know, for a person who's potentially entering that stage of life where those conditions can start to manifest, suddenly they get a boost in their engagement because they can suddenly see better again and they're kind of more active and more involved in life and, you know, back to playing bridge and, you know, things like that that keep your brain healthy.
And the simple joys. I mean, you even mentioned it yourself as a young person, seeing leaves on trees. There's something about being able to see properly that just...
appreciating all the beauty around you, yeah.
Yeah, just there is a joy in that. So should people seek surgery on their eyesight? I mean, look, I've done it myself. I've got glasses. So, yeah. You know, we're kind of patching over it, essentially. Should we actually seek to replace our 20/20 vision and restore it?
So that's a very, very good question. And I think people's opinion will vary depending on what type of eye surgeon you are. So refractive surgery is essentially vision correction surgery. So people who can't see 20/20 without the need for glasses or contact lenses, we help them to achieve that without the need for glasses or contact lenses. It's a little bit like wearing braces. You don't have to do it, but it can improve your quality of life if you do it. And most people, you know, who, you know, don't have perfect teeth will consider getting braces, or at least consider it for their children to get braces to improve their smile. You can think about it that way, but, you know, looking at it a different way, if you have an issue like you've got cataracts and you can't see properly, then absolutely you should consider surgery. I mean, if the risks and benefit ratio is something that you're happy to accept. You know, no surgery is without risk. So I don't think everybody should consider eye surgery, not at all. But I think a huge amount of people can benefit from it. The one area where I might say you should maybe consider it, you know, for the kind of young person, is for a person who's using contact lenses, you know, a lot, or overusing contact lenses, because contact lenses are not risk-free. And they're actually much riskier to use than glasses or having eye surgery. I mean, contact lenses are the main cause of corneal infections. You know, I worked in the eye and ear for a while during my training. And I mean, the huge majority of corneal infections are due to contact lens use. And then there are some really, really severe corneal infections that can blind you that are associated with contact lens use, something called acanthamoeba. So I suppose if anybody's listening to this and they do wear contact lenses, daily disposable lenses are by far the safest. They're the worst for the planet, unfortunately, but they're by far the safest for your own eyes. And you shouldn't overuse them. I mean, 8 hours a day is the maximum that people should be in contact lenses. And then never, ever swim or shower or kind of wash your face with fresh water in contact lenses, because these infections are all around us. It's just they get stuck under a contact lens and then suddenly they can start to affect your eye. The reality is that the huge majority of people, you know, young people who have healthy eyes other than a glasses correction, can achieve 20/20 vision with surgery. And I'm not going to ever say that everybody should have it done, but it's something that you many, many fewer people consider than could have it done. And mostly because they're worried about, you know, we are evolved to be protective about our eyes. You know, we want to protect them at all costs. So people who are maybe not fully informed about how safe it is naturally kind of have a predisposition to being worried about it. But it's much, much safer than a lot of things we do without thinking, like wearing contact lenses.
Yeah, well, I can see why you chose it. It's a fairly fascinating field. I could continue talking to you, but we'll have to leave it here. You'll find Brendan Cummins at the Beacon Clinic or the Wellington Eye Clinic. He's a consultant ophthalmic surgeon there. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Claire. Thanks.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, Christine Higgins, also known as Spiritual Wellness Christine on Instagram, and the woman behind the Full Moon Healing Circle on Killiney Beach, which won the Best Outdoor Experience in 2023. Every month, she gathers what can be up to 2,000 people on the beach in Killiney in Dublin, all to come together for a very special cause. The next one is on August 20th, and Christine Higgins joins me in studio now. Christine, you're very welcome.
Thank you so much.
So tell me a little bit about the the full moon sessions on the beach and how this idea came about?
Oh, like when I get that question, I'm always like, where do I start? Because it's just been such a journey for me on a personal level and also on a collective level. It really started during lockdown. I started teaching beach yoga on Cluny Beach all through lockdown. And I'm very in tune to Mother Nature. I'm very in tune with the energies that we're around, with the Grandmother Moon and the sun. And everyone was in Shavasana, and I just looked across the beach and I could just see this vision of all these people meditating. And I was like, this has to happen. This is what people need. And I was very conscious that, like, as we were all coming out of lockdown, that we were very disconnected from ourselves and disconnected from the community. So I really just wanted to bring everyone together.
Now, I've been to a number of them, and it's a great spot to watch the moon literally rise like the sun does. It's really special. I get excited every single time. But for those who don't know, explain what happens.
At the full moon. So we all open up sacred space. And then I'll do a little talk about the moon and where she is in the star signs. So she always has a different energy, a different vibration every month. So emotions may start bubbling up to the surface among everyone because we're very sensitive with the moon. We then go into then yoga. We do a light, slow yoga. I always say for people that arrive, they're not really into the yoga, I say, even if you're sitting on your mat and just absorbing the energy, that's absolutely fine. You've given yourself the space. Then I bring my friend, Breed with Neil. He comes in and does the breath work. And then I do a shamanic drumming meditation because I'm a shamanic practitioner as well.
And that's something I really noticed that was different about you. I'd never really come across that before. You're like calling in the energy of our ancestors and calling all this stuff in. I'd never really come across that before. So what's that all about?
So basically, shamanism, nothing to do with religion, has been around for longer than any religion, 40, 50,000 years. It's the way our ancestors lived. Like, they lived off the land. They relied on the sun to dictate the time. They also did rituals and ceremonies around the sun. They also did rituals and ceremonies around the moon. Particularly women used to come together for the moon, because if you think about it, it's 29.5 days of the moon travels through the sun. 29.5 days is when a woman is menstruating. We're so connected to the moon because the moon represents our emotions and our intuitions, and us women are powerful goddesses. We just have forgotten that we are. It's just a magical moment that I wanted to try and educate people in spirituality to say that we all have spiritual tendencies within us. We've just forgotten who we are.
So did you ever expect the beach ceremonies to grow the way they have? I mean,
no.
There's times you have a few thousand people on the beach.
We've had like about 2,000, particularly around the summertime. But I noticed a difference at winter this year, last year, was that there was more, even more people coming. So the weather wasn't putting anyone off. And Neil's always saying, like, I have the sixth sense about the weather, because he always rings me on the day we're having the event and he goes, okay, Christine, what's the weather today? And I predict it and I get it right all the time. I said, look, I have a deal with Mother Nature. She knows, like, we all need to be here and do this. So she's going to look after us. I think it's only rained once in the 3.5 years that we've been doing this.
Wow.
Yeah.
I can't believe that.
I know.
Because I have seen it called off. It might have been just that one time.
It was that one time. It was a weather warning and it was really, really windy. And I just said no. Like, when there's a weather warning, we can't ignore that. And myself and Neil are very passionate about creating a safe and sacred space. So if there's anything to do with that might put anyone in danger, like a weather warning, it's like no.
So I just think it's really interesting. Like, I live on the north side and, you know, Paddy Douglas also does full moon ceremonies and they are packed. I thought it was going to be quite niche. And the first time I walked around and saw the amount of people in the dunes, I was shocked. It was like a mini festival.
Oh, yeah.
And it's the same on the south side in Killiney. There is a real need for people to have a spiritual experience, to have that sense of community, isn't there?
Oh, 100%. It's what we're seeking. You know, there's a lot of people that feel lost out there, not complete, are searching, you know, and what they're searching for is connection, and connection not necessarily with others, but with themselves. And that's what spirituality does. You know, it really brings you inwards and sees that the power that you've been seeking for outside of you has been within you all this time. You just needed the key to open.
And you also have a very simple practice, which is really powerful, and people can do it at home.
Yeah.
Because it's monthly, you just write down things that aren't serving you anymore and you throw them into the fire. And I think that's just a really good way to assess how the month is going, to assess how things are, and to kind of try and put it behind you.
100%. Like a lot of people, they say they leave the beach after Full Moon Healing Circle so light and really excited for the month ahead. So it's like a reset, you know, because we hold so much emotion within us that it's sometimes we find that we're sinking, you know, we're drowning in our emotions. But when we rely on Grandmother Moon to literally take our emotions from us, because we're doing this ritual every month, it is cleansing us of those heavy emotions that are holding us back. So when we do the symbolism of writing on a piece of paper what we want to let go of, and we watch it burning in the fire, we're letting the universe transmute that energy and take care of it and free us from the heaviness.
Did you ever see yourself talking to that many people? You often say that on the microphone, that this was not part of the plan, that you would be speaking to 2,000 people.
No, because I have had to work through a lot of fears, and one big one is the fear of public speaking. So 3 years ago, like, I didn't really want to do this, but my soul was just pushing me that I had to do this. And I remember the first time, like, my knees were rattling, my voice was all over the place. And I remember picking up a bottle of water and my mouth was so dry, and I picked it up and there was two or three ladies in front, and my hand would not stop shaking, and I couldn't get the bottle of water into my mouth fast enough. But after I finished, the ladies came up and goes, "We didn't even know how you were going to do that, but suddenly you just went boom and you were like this confident, powerful goddess." So something happens where all the fear just melts away, and then I just step into my soul, my purpose.
You've also raised thousands for charity, because you ask everybody if they can to make a small donation, and you chose a suicide charity. Why was that?
I chose Suicide Survive because I've had mental health issues within my family. My dad had manic depression and schizophrenia, and in the 90s, you know, mental health was brushed under the carpet, and he became physically abusive as well. And my mom and dad split up, so we never saw my dad, but he lived in a very poor and very sad life. But it ripped our family in terms of I lost all his family, and he had like 8 or 9 brothers and sisters. So you can imagine all the cousins, you know, and it was that feeling of loss that I've and grief that I've been holding within me for years. And I just felt that when during lockdown, there was a lot of like people that like were taking their own lives. You know, I had a friend's older brother that took his own life on Cliney Beach in 2019, and another gentleman, 19 years of age, up Cliney Hill. You know, there was just so much going on, and I was like, I don't want any other family to go through what I went through in terms of how mental health affects them. So if I can create an event where now families make it their monthly outing, that mental health is talked about in the family, you know, and then also they have support. So even if it's one person in the house that's suffering a little bit, bringing them along to the beach, having this experience, know that they're not on their own and that they have this place to release the emotions that are just like sinking them, you know, drowning them. To me, then, me and my dad's experience and the life lessons I had to learn with him were not in vain.
Yeah. And, you know, you yourself have gone through tough times, as everybody does. And on paper, you were hugely successful. You were top of your career. You were working in the film industry. Is that right?
Yeah. So I had makeup business, special effects makeup. I distributed special effects makeup around Ireland and also into Europe. And like, I was at the top of my game, and my dad died in 2013, and all the repressed emotions that I buried really, really deep down started to bubble up. And then I was starting to get like triggered. I was panic attacks, anxiety, and I was pregnant on my 4th child. And it was just, I could see that I was drowning, you know. On the outside, everyone thought I was just, you know, really successful. And we all have our masks, you know, we all have our masks. And I had a big, huge mask on. But inside, like I used to drive down the N11 and want to just career into a wall just to have a break in a hospital. Like, just break a leg, just a leg, so I could lie in bed and not move for a couple of weeks just to get a break. You know, so it was... Yeah, it took one moment to me. That was, I was pregnant on my fourth child and I nearly died in labour. So I woke up in ICU after hemorrhaging and lost half my body weight in blood and had two blood transfusions.
Right, well, you got your rest in the hospital.
Yeah, I got my rest. I know. Be careful for your wish for. They're always listening.
But that was a rock bottom. So you didn't go back to your previous life. Is that when you started on this journey?
Yeah, like I had stayed in hospital 4 days and I was still though pushing against the grain because after the 4 days, like I was so drained, I had to walk back into the office with my daughter in her Moses basket to try and keep it together. And I remember just feeding her one day in the office and looking at her and going, this is not the way I'm supposed to be. I'm supposed to be cuddled up on the couch, snuggling my little girl and not having to worry about anything like this. So it was right then I promised her, I said, this can't continue. It's affecting the family. It's affecting me. I'm not being the best mother in terms of keeping my cup full, you know what I mean, to be able to serve and have a create a nice safe space for my children. So I sat there and then I said, right, I'm going to close down the business. I had no intentions of selling my business. I just posted up on Facebook saying I'm closing down. And then the phone rang one after the other with two competitors wanting to buy me out.
Wow.
So thank you.
Once you make the jump.
Yeah.
And you work one-on-one with people. So what are the things you hear time and time again?
Oh, it's a lot about people struggling, people lost, really not knowing where they are going in life. Also, they are getting triggered. They are suffering from panic attacks. They know that they're angry as well, you know, and frustrated of because they're not in alignment with themselves and where they think they're supposed to be in their lives. And I love just creating that sacred one-on-one space.
And so how is life for you now?
Well, I left all through that. I had a full-time job in UCD for 20 years. I had a career break and then I took another career break. And I'm 1 year after leaving the full-time pensionable job. The pension is gone.
But you're filling the beach. It's going to be okay. Well, you don't get paid for filling the beach.
I know,
but you
I
do.
Don't.
Not in money.
No, I get paid because in terms of knowing that I'm touching someone's heart and helping them.
And, you know, I think in a time of life where people are really lacking community, to be setting that up is a very special thing. If you want to find out more, you'll find Christine on Instagram. She's at Spiritual Wellness Christine. Christine Higgins, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Theo Kerwin founded Sprout & Co. with his brother Jack. Having fostered a love of cooking in their kitchen growing up and later training at Ballymaloe, they make healthy eating hot, in my opinion. I'm a regular to the Exchequer Street branch because it's hard to beat that mix of nutritious food and flavours in just one meal. Described as tasty food that just happens to be healthy, Theo has just published Saladology, a book packed with recipes inspired by the Kerwins' favourite food experiences and reimagining what a salad can be. And Theo Kerwin joins me in studio now. Well, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
So tell me about setting up Sprout with you and your brother. I'm always interested in what was the initial conversation and why did you want to set something up together?
Well, the Sprout as a restaurant concept is about 9 years old. My brother and I started that together. Jack's the CEO of the business and I'm the creative director. But before that, Sprout originally started as a cold pressed juice bar by my brother Jack, and he was about a year into juicing within an Avoca hand weavers as a concession there. And after about a year, he had one employee, and at 4 a.m. on a Saturday, he called me when I was tucked up in bed and said his one employee didn't show up and would I roll out and help him fulfill an order.
Just as well you weren't out in the town.
No. Fortunately, I wasn't and I was sober and I could drive in. But I went in, I helped him and we loved working together and that's kind of where it all started. So, truthfully, Jack really wanted to start a restaurant business. But when you are in your early 20s, to convince someone to back such a young guy to open a restaurant is very difficult. So Juice was a way for us to prove ourselves to eventually opening Sprout, the restaurant that people will know us for.
And that's the same ethos, though, isn't it? Like putting nutrition front and centre, but also making it a little bit cool, not in a gimmicky way, but making it really accessible, making it really tasty. That's still at the centre of what you do with the salads and the food at Sprout.
Yeah, I mean, it's always been about flavour. Even at the juice bar, we were always sourcing Irish ingredients and we were trying to make them as delicious, vegetable juices as delicious as possible. And the same approach to our restaurants, like Sprout has, we're all about flavour. We want to make really healthy food, but it has to be delicious. It has to get us really excited. And our approach has always been about sourcing produce from local producers and farmers and changing with the seasons, which is the best way to kind of get flavour into your food. It's the best way to make things delicious. So we work with the seasons and it keeps it really exciting. So
you've opened your own farm now, so a lot of the leaves are from your own farm, so that must have been an interesting development to kind of cut that supply chain a little bit.
Yeah, it was kind of a bit of madness. I think we started the farm about 6 years ago, and we have no farming experience, and within the first year we literally learned how to farm through YouTube, and we met a guy who had land, and Sprout had demand for leaf, which is our core product in the business. And we wanted that one core product to be really, really exceptional. So after a year of growing and figuring it out ourselves, we then met an amazingly passionate farmer in Kildare, a guy called Trevor Harris, who grows biodynamically and organically for us. So throughout the growing season, we'll have different varieties of salad leaves coming into the restaurants. So it basically means we can get fresher greens than you know, we could from just the standard market. We're literally able to plant the seeds, watch it grow, harvest it, wash it, serve it in the restaurants within about 24 hours. So it makes a massive difference to the quality of our food, but it's a big challenge.
And that's one of the problems with salads, isn't it? Because people might think, oh, I'm not really into salads, particularly here in Ireland with our wet and cold climate. But I think that's mainly because they're buying bagged leaves. Bagged leaves can be bad news. They can be soggy. They can be tasteless. There can be almost a chemical taste from some of them. So, you know, I think it's really important what you're doing. The fresher the leaf, the more locally sourced the leaf, the better it's going to taste.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very simple approach and it's been used by chefs and the best restaurants across the world for many, many years. So we wanted to take that approach to fast casual, how we could, you know, take that supply chain in-house and source from really great farmers across the country to create, you know, our style of food. But you touched on people not wanting to eat salads in the winter and cold salads. I think if anyone's not eaten in Sprout, or people, if they have experienced eating in Sprout, you know, we're not about creating salads that are cold and light and dainty. We want to create really full flavoured salads that have, like, you know, warm roasted chicken that's been marinated overnight, creating flavour through charring broccoli, for example, or warm grains and pickling vegetables to try and make that kind of salad experience. It's more of a, how do you eat lots of vegetables and make it really exciting than your typical salad.
Yeah, because it's also a complete meal, isn't it? You make sure you've got protein, fats and carbohydrates in each one, because that can also be a problem with a salad. Over the years, I used to congratulate myself for just having leaves and vegetables, but then I'd wonder why I was exhausted the next day. I mean, we really do need to be fueling ourselves correctly. And like I said in the intro, there's no way I would make something like that at home, that amount, that array of different sauces and ingredients and vegetables all chopped to that standard. Mm-hmm. So to be able to lean on something like that, I mean, I go weekly when I come in here to record with News Talk. So to know that once a week I get that access to that amount of nutrition in one bowl is a very good thing. But you have made it available for people to do at home. Tell me about the book, Saladology.
Yeah, we published Cellology in May, and it's been was a bestseller for a few months, which was amazing. And we're incredibly grateful that people were interested in what we had to say. But 9 years ago, when we opened our first restaurant, we got approached to write a cookbook. And I think wisely, we decided, you know, we weren't ready for that. We were in our early 20s and we were trying to figure out how to make a restaurant work, let alone write a book. And we also needed to grow up ourselves and find our story. So after, you know, we built the restaurants up to now 7 restaurants, 6 in Dublin and 1 in Kildare Village. And it felt like we were sharing recipes online, we were kind of building our social following, and it felt like finally we had a story to tell. We had a wealth of recipes from changing our menu seasonally so often, you know, of ideas that we could share. So it was great to put the sort of Sprout classics into the book. But as you said, there's a lot of, you know, you're not going to make a Sprout salad at home, because when you come to a Sprout restaurant, in each of our bowls, there's probably about 11 individual ingredients that go into that bowl, and each ingredient, each component might have multiple ingredients and processes to it. So it's very complex. So I wanted to share some of our classics for that avid Sprout customer that really likes our food. And then I wanted to share recipes that I love to make at home that are a bit simpler, because I want to get into the kitchen after a day's work, and I love to cook, but I don't want to be cooking for hours. So there's a lot of really simple salads in there, and really, you know, the style of food that I love to make at home. So there's a combination of that in the book.
And when I'm in the queue for the salad, you're on the wall on a screen, and you can see how simple you make it. So you might be making like a Romesco sauce with peppers, or you're marinating the chicken and then you're cooking it and you're bringing it all together. And like I say, I'm watching it almost in real time. So it's making it quick. Sometimes we just need to take the time and invest in ourselves and invest in good food. We say we don't have time, but it becomes a habit that you build on. I mean, I've really started to enjoy cooking in recent years, after years of saying I didn't have time. It's a de-stressor in many ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing for my head. Like, I love to, I think it's very meditative cooking. And I think, if, you know, watching my videos, everything that we do in Sprout is very simple. It has to be simple. We've got about 150 people working across the restaurants. So each process has to be simple. And cooking really is very simple when you add a little bit of imagination to it and a little bit of, you know, a combination of flavors, you can make something really delicious. So I hope that's in the book, that people, when they're reading Saladology and trying a recipe, they'll hopefully understand the process to it, and then be able to go off on their own journey of being creative with food, because, you know, there really are just lots and lots of simple processes that you can just, you know, you can change with the seasons or change with what you have in your store cupboard.
You mentioned growing your social media following. So is it true that when you went viral on TikTok with one of your recipes, you were actually in hospital with a collapsed lung? Tell us a little bit about that.
So as a result of the pandemic, how we got into making videos, first of all, was a result of the pandemic. We closed basically the whole estate down when the pandemic hit, and we kept one restaurant open and tried to keep as much of our team on as possible. And we eventually opened, had 3 restaurants running throughout the pandemic. We didn't have customers coming through the door anymore. It was more customers were ordering through a phone. And when you go to a Sprout restaurant, it's all about theater. You know, there is fridges filled with leaf from our farm. There's lots of colourful vegetables on display, and pickles and crunchy things around. And hopefully lots of energetic team members there to serve, and the music is playing loud. But for someone ordering through a phone, we didn't have that digital experience. So we said, let's start making some videos and try to make that experience more fun. So at the time we had a vacant restaurant on the Quays, Sir John Rutland Quay, which is now reopened. But we turned that into a studio, and I started with my brother making our most popular dishes and posting them on Instagram. And that went really well. And then there was this new emerging TikTok app that someone encouraged me to to post a video on. And I think I did it on a Thursday evening. I posted it without, we had like 500 followers on it, and I didn't think much about it. And then I went about my day, and suddenly I had a sharp pain in my lung, and I had to go to hospital. And by about 10 hours in the hospital, they said, you have a collapsed lung. And I was rushed into emergency surgery, and I woke up in an ICU.
Bit of a superhero to be pushing through. I mean, a sharp pain, but you weren't that debilitated by it.
Well, I was in a lot of pain and it was very surreal. But yeah, I looked around me, and there was people with heart, you know, suffering heart attacks and whatnot. And I was being cared by amazing nurses and doctors. But then I took out my phone, and I was suddenly going viral on TikTok and turning to a nurse and going, I think I'm going viral. And the Saturday video, I posted that Saturday video, and it's now got over a million views. And it kind of catapulted us going all in on making more recipe content and building our following. I think we went, you know, at the start of, before we ever made videos, we had about 17,000 followers on across everything. And now we have about 200,000 followers across all the platforms. So it rolled into the cookbook and has opened up lots of doors for us. And that experience of big TV screens in the restaurants when you come in, we're able to show our customers and our followers just how we make our food and hopefully get them excited.
Yeah, for sure. So what is the most popular order in Sprout?
Well, it's ever changing, but we change our menu seasonally, and we've just introduced fish to our menu. It's going really, really well, and that's become a really big seller. So it's called, one of the dishes is called the Bangkok Fishbowl, and we're using trout from Kilkenny, Goatsbridge trout, which is really exciting to see that Irish people are open to the idea of eating trout as an alternative fish. So that's going really well. Probably number one top seller is now the Crispy Bombay Bowl, which is an Indian-inspired bowl that is really delicious. And in Saladology, there's a recipe called the chat potatoes that are probably the most addictive potatoes you'll ever have.
And is that inspired by something your mum used to make when you were a kid?
That's a different story. So one of our other most popular dishes is our paprika chica. It has got this garlicky paprika yogurt on top. And basically when we were kids, my mum used to chop up lots of crunchy vegetables, like carrots and peppers and cucumbers and maybe the odd potato crisp. And she would make this dip called, we called it Mum's Spanish Dip. And it was basically like a healthier aioli. So it's mainly yogurt with a little bit of mayonnaise and garlic. And it is very, very delicious. And as kids, we would dip vegetables in and go mad for it. So it was a great way for her to get all her kids eating lots of vegetables.
Brilliant. Well, I thought Mama Curran had better get a shout out, because
thank
it's
you.
Nice that she's fused down into
she
the food.
She will be very smug at home now with a big smile
good
on her
stuff.
Face.
Well,
she
I'm
deserves
a,
it.
I rotate between chickpeas and Umami Knows Best, and I change with the seasons too. So I can't wait to see what's next and maybe try that fish one. So you're mainly in Dublin. I know you do have one in Kildare Outlet Village. I'm a regular if ever I'm there as well.
Thank you.
Do you plan on going outside of the East? Is there any plans for Sprout to go throughout the country?
Yeah, we'd love to do that. And it's hopefully it's in our plans, and hopefully we'll be able to announce something very soon about different counties across Ireland.
Amazing, because I'm always really conscious that this is a national radio station, and I don't like to do too many stories that are Dublin centric, but this is an ethos. The work that you do at Sprout is an ethos, and I hope it bleeds out across the country. And of course, everybody can get their hands on the book. It is called Saladology. Theo Kerwin of Sprout & Co. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me.
So that's it for Alive and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Aidan McKelvey, and Hugo De Silva Scott, who was on sound. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk.